from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in March when the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Agency sent out a notice about the long-discussed wall along the Mexican border. You've heard President Trump say many times that we will build a wall, that it will be long, tall, and beautiful, and you probably also know that Mexico has no plans to pay for it. But the Washington Post reports yesterday that Congress has set aside $20 million in this year's budget for prototypes, and those plans are going forward. The wall could very well happen. Back in March, vendors were asked to forbid for the chance to build the wall, and now in November, six companies have chosen to build a total of, they've been chosen, I should say, to build a total of eight border wall prototypes. The agency told companies that the wall has to be at least 18 feet tall, but 30 feet is ideal. The wall should be built to prevent someone from climbing to the top unassisted, so one of the prototypes, by the way, has spikes built into it. The wall should be visually pleasing and blend into the landscape. Some of the prototypes are earth-toned, some with concrete, others with rounded piping at the top. Designers were told that the wall should be built so that no one could create a hole larger than a foot around using handheld tools in under an hour. And the wall must be built to prevent tunneling below it for at least 6 feet underground. Maybe this is the first you're hearing about this, but make no mistake, the Trump administration remains very serious about building that wall. Over the next 2 months, companies are building their prototypes along the border between San Diego and Tijuana. Will Congress ultimately decide to pay for a full border wall nearly 2,000 miles long? That's not clear, but they've already set aside $20 million, and the president says we should expect to see it happen. That is just one of many subjects that we can explore this hour, as the Rochester Committee on Latin America is welcoming Daniela Berge Palomino, the Senior Associate for Mexico, Border Issues, and Migrant Rights at the Latin America Working Group in Washington, D.C. She coordinates LAWG's campaigns to promote justice for Mexico and the borderlands, and tonight she is part of an event at 7 p.m. at the Downtown United Presbyterian Church. But first, she is our guest on Connections. And Daniela, it's great to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Evan. Thanks for having me.
Also with us in studio is Esperanza Roncero, who's a professor of Spanish in the Department of Foreign Languages and Literature at Nazareth College. Esperanza, welcome. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you very much.
Tonight, 7 p.m. at the Downtown United Presbyterian Church is an event that is free and open to the public, Esperanza, yes?
Yes, that's right. Pretty much every Wednesday, every first Wednesday of the month, we have an event, and tonight we are hosting Daniela to come and talk to us about immigration.
And why does this issue, why are these issues so relevant right now to you? What do you want the public to know about tonight's event?
Well, I mean, I think the issue of immigration and what is happening to the people who are in this country, it is crucial to understand basically, what is the situation that these people are going through? What are the political implications? What are the ways in which we can participate as citizens of the United States in order to protect some of our most vulnerable communities here in Rochester? So this is a way for us to be able to bring awareness to this and to bring the community together with this subject. And to be, we are one more members of this dialogue, that's all.
Yeah. Daniela, why don't you tell us a little bit more about what the Latin America Working Group is first, and then we'll start talking about these issues.
Sure. So Latin America Working Group LOG was founded over 20 years ago, basically as a working group, as a real coalition of environmental solidarity, immigrant rights, human rights groups in the U.S. that were concerned about what the U.S. was doing in Latin America at that time in the 80s in Central America. And we very much operate still as a working group, and our primary mission is to influence U.S. policies in the Americas and to make sure that they're rooted in human rights and justice. And basically, we do that sort of at three levels, still working very much in coalition with our partners, both here in the U.S., in D.C., across the U.S. and in Latin America with our civil society organizations, human rights defenders that we work with, directly in Washington, D.C., with policymakers, with Congress, with the administration, less so these days. And then the third way that we work is through our growing grassroots activist base. So with concerned citizens like members of RACLA across the U.S. who we call on, engage, and educate about some of the most pressing issues in the Americas today.
I think, I wanted to start on the wall just because, there's the headline this week and we're seeing these prototypes. And from my experience, and maybe this is wrong, but when you talk about a border wall with Mexico, Trump supporters say, great, let's see it. Trump opponents tend to laugh at it now. They're sort of dismissive of it. They say Mexico will never pay for it, that it's not serious. And yet the Washington Post reporting this week says to me that they are very specific about this, that they are getting to a point where at least we're seeing prototypes. Should we be laughing and be dismissive about this, or do you think it's possible?
We shouldn't be laughing because the wall, the border wall, really is a symbol of this administration's anti-immigrant and anti-refugee policies, which we as LOG have seen as an attack, not just on our communities here, but an attack on our Latin American neighbors. The way that the administration has painted the wall as, you know, part of its divisive rhetoric, not only with Mexico, but really as a symbol for the rest of Latin America, really paints a picture for what its vision is of immigration in the United States, which is really limiting it at all costs, not just undocumented immigration, but there's even proposals to limit legal immigration, the hiring of legal immigrants in the workforce. And so the rhetoric is extremely concerning. We should take it seriously. I think we probably didn't take it seriously enough previously. And the prototypes are moving forward. The reality is, though, that Congress needs to provide a lot of funding for this. So we still have to wait and see to the extent that that's going to actually be approved. And I think there's been a lot of arguments, even from within the Department of Homeland Security, to say, to really question the administration on, we already have, you know, 700 miles of fencing as it is. So why more do we need, you know, an actual border wall? It's not what border communities want. It's not what even Customs and Border Protection has called for in itself.
Let's listen to a little bit if we have it. And let me ask our engineer, John. Hi, John. Well, John's busy. We'll get John in just a second here. But I think we've got some sound from President Trump, and we'll listen to some of what he had to say about it. It sounds to you like it's one thing to say we're going to try prototypes. It's another to say we're going to allocate billions upon billions to build the wall. But that's where I wanted to start here, because if you're taking it seriously at LOG, the Latin America Working Group, then I think the broader public might take it a little bit more seriously. So prototypes, one thing. What are the odds do you think we actually see this thing go forward?
Well, it's not just prototypes, too. So this, you know, $20 billion that we're talking about, this border security package that the administration has tried to push forward, is not just fencing and infrastructure equipment for a border wall, but it's really basically to militarize the entire zone of the U.S.-Mexico border, which also includes, you know, an additional 500 Customs and Border Protection, Border Patrol agents. It also includes 1,000, you know, ICE officials, Immigration and Customs Enforcement agencies, to apprehend and deport people in the interior of the country. So it's part of a much broader package that we at LOG and other advocates are really fighting against, because, again, this money could be going somewhere else, and there's really no need for it as it stands. The border communities, you know, across the U.S. are some of the safest in the country. Like I said, there already is, you know, a level of infrastructure at the border that tons of money have been poured into. And the reality is that migration flows, you know, have been down for the last 20 or so years. And so also this rhetoric that we're somehow being overwhelmed by migrants from the south just isn't true at all. I think there is a real likelihood, and there is interest from Congress in funding some pieces of the border security package. Certainly that's been a part of, you know, immigration reform discussions going back several years. And so the likelihood is that some piece of this will pass. But our concern is at what cost? And so there's a lot of negotiations right now happening, you know, with regards to the DREAM Act to protect the 800-something thousand DREAMers. And what we're thinking is that there could be some sort of negotiation between a border security package and the passage of some of these other protections for immigrants like the DREAM Act.
All right, so listeners, if you've got any questions or comments on any of these subjects as we discuss immigration, deportation, the Trump administration's policy on these issues, we'll talk about the so-called drug war, a border wall, you can call 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Just about 6 weeks ago, the president was in Arizona, and he had a lot to say about these issues. Let's listen to some of what he had to say about a couple of issues that are first and foremost that you might hear discussed tonight.
We are cracking down on the sanctuary cities that shield criminal aliens, finally. And we are building a wall on the southern border, which is absolutely necessary. Build that wall. Now, the obstructionist Democrats would like us not to do it, but believe me, if we have to close down our government, we're building that wall.
If we have to close down the government, He says it's getting done. So there's some of the president's comments on the wall. We can hit that some more if you want, listeners, but let's move to a separate subject that you just heard the president start with there. He said we are cracking down on sanctuary cities. I presume he also means potentially sanctuary counties, which, as Vox and others have explained, generally deal more with how those cities and their governments instruct police officers to work with undocumented people. Let's say someone is pulled over for a traffic infraction and they happen to be undocumented. The question becomes, how much information are you sharing with the federal government? Are you calling in immigration, and are there other consequences? Sanctuary cities tend to kind of shield some of those consequences. The president says, Daniela, that they're coming after those cities and counties. Is that rhetoric? Or are we seeing that actually happen?
Well, it's rhetoric at this point that is attempting to be implemented through various bills that are in Congress right now. But in reality, that's just one piece that the administration has held up of its much broader anti-immigrant, anti-refugee vision and crackdown that we're seeing, in which we've seen a 40% increase in apprehensions of all undocumented immigrants within the U.S. and really sort of no priorities.
40% increase this year?
This year compared to the first few months of last year, although not higher than some of the earlier years during the Obama administration yet. Of course, we certainly had some issues with the Obama administration's immigration policies as well. But the reality is that right now, there are no priorities in terms of who to go after of undocumented immigrants. And we're seeing, you know, women, we're seeing unaccompanied children being picked up. And we're seeing a real pressure on cities to cooperate with federal immigration law enforcement. So the apprehensions piece, the sanctuary sort of crackdown is another piece. We're seeing also, an environment in which immigration enforcement agencies like ICE and CBP are extremely empowered, and they feel like they can go after anyone they want. We're seeing also, for example, at the border, turnbacks of asylum seekers, of mostly families and children from Central America at this point, who are claiming some sort of fear and seeking international protection at the U.S. And we're seeing, you know, proposals to cut overall refugee admissions from all over the world, including from Latin America. So the sanctuary, the crackdown on sanctuary cities is really just one piece of basically what the administration has put out as its vision for immigration. And those pieces are consistently something that's put out since its first week with its three executive orders on border security, immigration, enforcement within the interior of the country, and then also the infamous Muslim ban, which also had an impact on Latin America. And then just a couple of weeks ago, the administration again put out its White House sort of wish list on immigration, which were a series of principles, which again sort of touch on all of these issues. And basically, that's a way of pressuring Congress to say, you know, this is what we would like to see happen. The reality is we have seen aspects of all of those different policies being implemented slowly.
Two follow-up questions to that. You just mentioned that the so-called Muslim ban impacted Latin America, yes?
That's correct.
How's that?
Correct. So under the Obama administration, there was a very small program set up in Central America by which families and children could apply for refugee protections with the U.S. Embassy without having to leave their home country, without having to make the journey to the U.S. and Mexico. It was a very small program, only about 2,000 children ended up applying. But it fits within the U.S. broader refugee admissions program because it's, again, from abroad, right, from the outside. And through that Muslim ban, there was a limitation and a delay in refugee processing from all over the world, including from Central America. And so a lot of those kids that were already in the pipeline to receive some sort of refugee protection and to eventually come to the U.S. and be reunited with their families were delayed initially at the beginning of this year, and just in August and September recently, that program is now being phased out. So it was really the only program that existed by which families and children from Central America could apply for some sort of protection without having to come to the U.S. Again, it was a small program. You know, we as advocates weren't super thrilled by it, but it was one possibility. And so that's something a lot of people actually don't know from that Muslim ban and the overall cuts on refugee admissions, is that actually it did affect Central America as well.
And when it comes to the status of cities or counties as so-called sanctuary cities and counties, we're in the midst of a race for Monroe County Sheriff here. The incumbent, the Republican Patrick O'Flynn, opposes our county becoming a sanctuary county. Now, Democrats in the county legislature have proposed that. The Democrat in the race, Todd Baxter, also opposes that. So neither candidate for sheriff says that they would like to see us become a sanctuary county, but they also say that they enforce the law. Their job is not to make policy. So we'll see. And again, if you've got questions or comments on that, it's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I'd like to read an email from a listener named Don who points to a headline from USA Today. And the headline was, quote, "Treatment of immigrants in Mexico much worse than any other country." And I'll quote from the piece, quote, "While Mexican politicians complain about the mistreatment of Mexican immigrants fleeing to the United States, Mexico is far more abusive towards Central and South American migrants who seek asylum, human rights groups allege. Many of the tens of thousands of refugees fleeing violence in their home countries are routinely preyed upon by both criminal organizations and corrupt government officials in Mexico," the Washington Office on Latin America, a nonprofit rights group, said in a report issued this past May. End quote. And so Don writes to us, says, "Would your guest speak to how Central American countries treat their own illegal immigrants? What do they do with their own dreamers? And is it fair to make this comparison?"
Central American or Mexican?
Let's start with Mexico.
Okay, sure. So yes, Mexico has a huge role to play in the discussion of Central American migration and the really Central America refugee crisis, primarily because it's been a transit country for many years for Central Americans, crossing through and making their way to the U.S. Increasingly, it's becoming a destination country for Central American migrants who are increasingly claiming asylum there. But basically what's happened over the last 3 years is that the U.S. has increasingly pressured Mexico to step up enforcement along its own southern border with Guatemala to stop the flow of Central American migrants arriving to the U.S. And this basically rhetoric arose in 2014 and 2015, right after the so-called unaccompanied child migrant crisis to the U.S., when we saw large numbers of unaccompanied children from Central America arriving at the U.S. And the U.S. Funded Mexico to step up its own southern border enforcement, say at the Mexico-Guatemala border. And what was a result of that in 2015 was that Mexico deported more Central American migrants than the U.S. did that year. So we really saw a sort of harsh enforcement by Mexican migration officials, turning Central American migrants back to Central America many times, majority of times, without ensuring that they had a chance to raise credible fear, a chance to express their need to seek international protection in Mexico. Since then, we've seen Mexican migration officials continue that sort of harsh enforcement. Obviously, Mexico has its own interests in securing its own border and really, I think, is grappling right now with the fact that it's becoming a country of destination for Central American migrants. Asylum figures in Mexico have tripled. In 2015, they hovered around 3,500. Last year, they had 8,600 asylum applications. And this year, they're projected to receive 20,000, the majority from Central American, countries, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. And the reality is that Mexico's asylum agency is extremely weak. It only has 3 offices in the whole country. And a tenth of the budget of Mexico's migration enforcement. So we still see a model in which Mexico is prioritizing migration enforcement and border enforcement, not really strengthening its refugee assistance programs, and through which Central American migrants, you know, increasingly experience extreme levels of, you know, rights violations in their crossing through Mexico at the hands of organized crime, but also very much in collusion with Mexican police, Mexican military, Mexico migration enforcement that hand Central American migrants over to organized crime. And Central American migrants are, you know, kidnapped, disappeared, you know, sexually assaulted. And very few times actually have access to present their claims for asylum. So what we could see, you know, as the U.S. increasingly closes its own borders and as there's a crackdown within the interior of the U.S., is that, you know, what's happening in Mexico in terms of Central American migrants arriving there and trying to seek a living there to the extent that they can, that's a reflection of not only a Central American refugee crisis, but also to the extent that people are continuing to seek protection, not only in Mexico, but we've also heard asylum claims go up in Costa Rica and Belize and other countries in the region from Central America. So Mexico right now, especially, you know, before the U.S., has been definitely talking the talk of protecting its own migrants, its own citizens in the U.S. but still has a long way to go in how it really walks that talk in terms of protecting and recognizing the rights of Central American migrants within its territory.
And so Daniela Don, the emailer, is someone who has expressed concern about this issue in the past and says he is not a big fan of this president, but he supports a border wall because he feels that in his read of the subject, people need to be treated better. Coming to the United States is not the way to solve the problem, that we should take our political capital and bring to bear some pressure on Mexico and other countries that are mistreating their own, in his words, illegal immigrants, as opposed to saying, hey, let them in here. He said, why not put pressure on Mexico to stop mistreating, to stop abusing, to stop tolerating those abuses that happen from police and other parts of Mexico, as opposed to saying, you know, don't build the wall and allow them to come here?
Well, the reality is that all governments, you know, have the right to secure their own borders and protect their own national interests, of course, but they also have a right. They also have an obligation to respond to people who are fleeing violence and who are seeking protection at their borders. And so what we're saying is that, you know, Mexico, of course, Mexico and all the other Central American countries, the Central American governments have a right, you know, have an obligation to respond to their own citizens and the violence and the displacement they're facing within their own country. But the United States also has an obligation to respond to the asylum seekers that are claiming fear at their own border. So it's not so much about a border wall. It's about how do we better allocate our own resources that we have and not spend them on wasteful things that already exist, like a border wall, but really focus on fixing our immigration system, which has been broken for several years, and, you know, in which many of the large percentage of the immigrant community here in the U.S. is contributing to the economy, has been here, like, you know, a population like the Dreamers, like other undocumented immigrants has been here contributing for many years, paying taxes, you know, aren't criminals by and large, and they don't have a way to eventually access permanent residency here or eventually fix their status. What has been given to them have been temporary sort of protections over and over. And so I guess I would say that, you know, we need to focus on improving our immigration system once and for all and addressing, you know, some of those gaps and better allocating our resources. But then also still, you know, we have an obligation to all those who come, you know, seeking protection here.
My guest is Daniela Burgi Palomino, a senior associate for Mexico, border issues and migrant rights at the Latin America Working Group in Washington, D.C., and she is in Rochester for an event tonight at 7 p.m. at the Downtown United Presbyterian Church. That's on North Fitzhugh Street in Rochester at 7 p.m. tonight. Human Rights in Mexico, Immigration, and Two Borders. It's an event that is free and open to the public, wheelchair accessible, and looped for the hearing impaired. So at 7 o'clock tonight for that event. And why don't we, before we take our first phone call here, Daniela, when it comes to immigration, what's the ideal? You know, if LOG, the Latin America Working Group, has, you know, a chance to say, the Trump administration surprised you and said, you know what, you guys tell us what the policy should be, and we're going to green light what you want. What do you want? What's the ideal when it comes to net immigration, what we allow from Mexico and other sources, and how does that differ with the current reality? Yeah.
So, sure. So we've seen, I mean, our perspective has always been one of focusing on U.S. foreign policies really to the region. And we see migration from the region, primarily from Central America, you know, as having a lot of linkages with what the U.S. has really done in terms of its foreign policies, in terms of driving migration, you know, since the 80s to the U.S. And so, you know, in our ideal, you know, starting off right now, clearly the immigration system, like I said, I mean, years ago, we would have, you know, liked to have seen some sort of comprehensive immigration package, but that's, you know, no longer really a reality at this time. What we're seeing is sort of, you know, temporary and smaller measures to address the immigration system, sort of. And so, you know, starting at the border, there needs to be, you know, processing of asylum seekers in the way that they should. And that means that we need to have, you know, allocated immigration officials that really take time away from Customs and Border Protection to be actually doing what they should be doing, which is securing the border and not having to deal, you know, take care of unaccompanied children, but processing asylum seekers in a way that, you know, gives them the right to have an interview, doesn't leave them in detention facilities for months at a time, which at the end cost the U.S. taxpayer, you know, endless amounts of money. And really what they do is just house people in, you know, horrible conditions and aren't really a solution longer term. That's one, you know, at the border. Secondly, we need to see a fix so that the undocumented population in the U.S., including the 800,000 Dreamers, and also right now something we've been working on a lot is the 300,000 Central Americans that have temporary protected status, which is also the administration is set to make a decision on just next week, who have been here for the past 20 years. Again, that these folks have a chance to, you know, prove that they've been in line with the law for the past few years that they've been here and have a chance to apply for permanent residence and eventually a path to citizenship as well. And thirdly, we would say for in terms of refugee admissions, we'd like to see a level of refugee admissions that's been globally, that's been in line with what the U.S. has accepted for the past 10 years, which is around 110,000 refugees.
Annually
from around the world. Right now, the proposal from the administration is for 45,000 for next year. That's the lowest historically that the U.S. has ever accepted, and only 1,500 from Latin America as a part of that number for the entire Latin American region. And so we're also opposed to that. So concretely, you know, what we're calling for most in the next few months is a clean DREAM Act. So a DREAM Act that would protect the 800,000 Dreamers that are currently about to lose their status over the next year. And by what I mean by clean is one that isn't negotiated at the cost of border militarization, of increased border security funds that I said, again, are wasteful, ineffective, and not really what border communities want to begin with, or what even the, you know, the own Customs and Border Protection haven't called for, or even local municipal officials from the border haven't called for that as well. They'd much rather the funding be spent on, you know, ports of entry or kind of renovating some of the infrastructure to facilitate trade. And secondly, to protect, again, the asylum seekers that are coming from Central America by processing, by, you know, mechanisms for due process that actually allow them to present their claims.
All right, let's get our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back to Ellen on the phone. Ellen, we'll come to you. If you also, if you want to call the program, weigh in on these issues, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I've got a pile of your emails as well. We'll hit some other issues related to the so-called drug war and how that is impacting current policy. So let's do all of that after our only break of the hour right here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, is the bubble going to burst for craft beer in Western New York? The closing of a local brewery had some wondering if craft beer has seen its peak in the Rochester Finger Lakes region and if there's a market correction coming. Well, the answer is more complicated, but if you love craft beer, it'll make you a little more optimistic about its future. We're going to talk with Will Cleveland from the Democrat and Chronicle and local members of the craft beer community to explore its future next hour. All right, welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let me get to our first phone call. This is Ellen in Mendon. Go ahead, Ellen.
Hi. Well, what I want to address is that, you know, the administration doesn't have any reasonable policy right now. And I head the Rochester chapter of No One Left Behind. We resettle interpreters and support personnel who worked for the U.S. military. When the ban hit in January, we had interpreters and their families turned back at the airport and told to go home. And we just had a case that I started dealing with last night where an interpreter was given his special immigrant visa. He had passed all of his security checks. He had done everything he was supposed to do. He went from Frankfurt to Reykjavik, and he was supposed to get a flight from Reykjavik to here. He was stopped in Reykjavik. Homeland Security said his visa, that there was something wrong with his visa, even though the embassy in Reykjavik said, no, this was a validly issued visa, and he's being told now he's got to go back to Frankfurt, Germany, to deal with this, and we're saying, to what end? And when we called the International Refugee Assistance Project, who has helped our clients in the past, they said that they are seeing this now as a trend with those with validly issued visas to immigrate to the U.S. So it's not just that our policy is broken on who we accept, even after we've accepted them, we're now turning them away, and we can't even get them into the country. And I really want to highlight this, because this is so broken, and it is affecting those who have been thoroughly screened. We know what they did, and we know that they've saved soldiers' lives, and yet they're still not being permitted in the U.S.
Ellen, thanks for the phone call. Some thoughts on that, Daniela?
Yeah, no, Ellen's absolutely right. This extends, again, not just to who we're letting into the country, to the numbers of apprehensions that we're seeing within the country, but also, like I said, there's been a real emphasis to just really make it harder for all immigrants, even ones with special visas, like the case that you're talking about, Ellen, to come here, to delay their processing, to ask more questions, when all of us know, you know, especially you who work on some of these cases very closely, that folks with special immigrant visas, refugees, other folks with, you know, other types of visas are some of the most vetted people that, you know, there are, that already have had to wait months, sometimes even years, to undergo all the background checks and everything that needs to happen. And this administration simply thinks it's not enough. But I think there's a lot of myths to that, and really lack of understanding of what the actual process is for someone to come here. On that specific case, you know, it's great you're working with IRAP and organizations like them. Basically, there's a real need to document all sorts of those kinds of violations of due process and kind of experiences like the ones that you're seeing. And there are, you know, offices within Department of Homeland Security, the Office of, you know, Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, where advocates are consistently documenting these types of cases and raising them as examples.
Ellen, you want to follow up there?
What troubles me is that IRAP just says that there's nothing they can do. So we have a guy, it's like living in that movie, The Terminal. So I've got a guy stuck in Reykjavik, right? And he was allowed in Germany because his life was threatened for helping the U.S. military, because we couldn't process his visa fast enough. But yet, if he goes back to Germany, Germany was like, well, yeah, he can stay here until the U.S. issues his visa. So we issue his visa, and now he's being told, oh, sorry, go back to Germany. So what he's going to have to do is go back to the German courts and say, well, yeah, the U.S. issued my visa, and now they won't let me in. I mean, this is insane. This is absolutely insane. And I just wanted to explain to people, like, what is going on even when they are allowed in legally or allegedly allowed in legally, and there's absolutely nothing we can do. That's what we're told. There's nothing we can do.
Well, Ellen,
and it affects national security. How do we tell these guys, oh, you risked your life and too bad? I mean, this has huge, huge implications.
Ellen, thanks for the phone call. Any disagreement on the last points there, Daniela?
No, I'm extremely frustrated. I'm right there with you, Ellen.
Let me read some emails from listeners, and we'll try to do them quickly here. I know you've got more phone calls and comments to get to. Listener writes, a wall is an in-your-face symbol of fear, exactly the tool that radical groups have been trying to instill here since 9/11, and it's why Trump won. Agree or disagree with that, Daniela?
It is, yeah. It's a symbol of fear and the hate and, you know, the xenophobia that, you know, calls basically to Trump supporters.
CT writes to us and says, hey, Mexico has factories that make letters, you know. Yeah, you know, I know that's a cheeky comment, the kind of thing we've heard before. So, CT, I know it's half humorous there. But let me just reiterate again, the prototypes that are being built now, and the Trump administration called for six companies to build eight different prototypes. The Washington Post, and we've posted it on various social media if you want to read it, the Washington Post has a breakdown of the eight prototype walls. They're essentially 30 feet tall. Some of them have spikes in the side. Some of them are sort of rippled and made in a way that's very hard to climb. And so I don't know, Daniela. I mean, I know what CT is saying. They're joking about ladders. But if they actually do this thing, a 30-foot wall for 1,900 miles, not 700 miles of fencing like they have now, that'd be very different, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but I think there's still a lot of uncertainty. I was actually at a meeting yesterday with CBP and their headquarters, and they were kind of going out, you know, going over their plans and where they're at in terms of operationally, you know, exploring the prototypes. And they even themselves, you know, said that a lot of it, the future is still, you know, they don't have the funding allocated to really move forward beyond the exploration right now. And what we tried to highlight, and where I think, you know, there can be a lot of pushback still, is you know, they haven't consulted at all with local communities, and I'm not just talking about local immigrant communities. I'm talking about local municipal and city officials who, like I said, this is like the last thing they're calling for. Who they'd much rather see sort of port of entry infrastructure renovations and those types of things. So I think it is moving forward to some degree and would have you know, some implications, but we've already had a border wall as well.
Herman in Brighton writes and says, our senators and my representatives in Congress are already opposed to Trump's immigration and refugee policies. I already called them to give them my opinions, and I've made donations to nonprofits like HIAS that help refugees and advocate for them. What more can I do to try to influence the administration's policies on the issues your guest is talking about?
That's great. Certainly, we think pressuring your congressmen and senators is the way to go. What I would actually say is that even if they've already expressed support for, you know, or expressed opposition to the president's anti-immigrant, anti-refugee executive orders, actually, you really need to keep at it, because right now we're at a very critical moment where the FY18 budget proposal is still under debate, and there's a lot of negotiations happening, like I said, where there could be significant trade-offs, and where border security, even some of the Democrats that have supported, you know, protections for DREAMers, are very susceptible right now to being negotiated and swayed one way or another, particularly on the border security package. And we also think that, you know, the DREAMers have gotten a lot of attention. Certainly, it's a population that has advocated for itself a lot. But there's a whole series of other, you know, undocumented immigrant populations and asylum seekers themselves. So I think pointing out that the undocumented immigrant population isn't just one, you know, a holistic swath of people, but that they're really, the administration is seeking to attack multiple, you know, subsectors of that. So I think I would say keep at it with the pressure. We're at a critical moment right now, and people are likely to be swayed. Negotiations are happening, and just really highlight the impacts on all the population, not just DREAMers.
Before I get back to your phone calls, I'll remind you that our guest this hour is Daniela Berge-Palomino, the Senior Associate for Mexico, Border Issues, and Migrant Rights at the Latin America Working Group in Washington, D.C., and she's in Rochester for an event tonight with the Rochester Committee on Latin America. It's the event at 7 p.m. tonight at the Downtown United Presbyterian Church on North Fitzhugh Street. It's free and open to the public, and her subject, Human Rights in Mexico, Immigration, and Two Borders. That's tonight at 7 p.m. Ray writes to the program. Ray says, why does the U.S. have an obligation to accept people from these countries? How has the U.S. destabilized Mexico, Honduras, Nicaragua, and others in the past? Many talk about the symptoms of this, gang warfare, drug trafficking, and government corruption. But few who oppose people crossing our borders understand the root causes. Please teach listeners on U.S. history with Latin America and the exploitations in the past several decades that have set the stage for this situation. People need this knowledge if they are to persuade others differently who want to, quote, build the wall. Comrade Daniela.
Yeah, that's totally right. And it's a very important piece of all of this. And one, like I said, that LOG has actually been trying to highlight as well is the root causes. And I think what's been in the media for the past couple of years since the unaccompanied child migrant crisis is that the root causes is, you know, gang violence and organized crime. But really, it's exactly what one of your listeners was pointing at, which is that the root causes go actually a lot further back, you know, to U.S. policies in Central America in particular, when the U.S. was funding a lot of the right-wing groups who were, you know, disappearing, kidnapping, committing all sorts of rights violations, the military security forces, that destabilized those countries Guatemala and El Salvador in particular. And that left a really a state of weak institutions and governments that never fully recovered from an era in which, you know, guns and arms were freely trafficked, and again, which the U.S. heavily funded. And then that, you know, the gang violence issue was in part also influenced by U.S. immigration policies. Going back to the 90s, when many gang members from the United States were deported back to countries like El Salvador, and again, because the countries were just recovering from civil wars and from these situations of violence where the U.S. played a strong role, negative role, you had a situation where gang members, you know, had easy access to arms and weapons still, and really, you know, weak governments. And so they took on this role, the kind of territorial control that we're now seeing. So, for example, in El Salvador, really, you know, I was there at the beginning of August, you know, government officials even themselves tell us there's no safe place to hide here from gangs. We as a government don't have the capacity to protect people. And that's the kind of situation that we're seeing in the three countries, but particularly in El Salvador and Honduras currently, who have, you know, some of the highest homicide rates in the world. And where, again, it's not just gang violence, it's not just organized crime, but the levels of collusion and corruption by government officials themselves. And, you know, no sort of strong justice system to address crimes that the everyday citizen experiences. And so it's not just violence, but it's also, you know, when you are raped or when you are facing a situation of extortion, you have nowhere to turn because the police is not responsive. You know, they don't get paid enough. And justice systems are too weak or colluded by, you know, sort of narco states. And so people have no other option but to flee. But again, going back to the original point, you know, there are high levels of violence, but we really do have to address some of the root causes and to make sure, and the root causes go back, as I said, again, to U.S. foreign policy and how the U.S., you know, continues to take this stance of addressing, you know, the drug wars, addressing gang violence as a way to really continue implementing these sort of militarized security strategies.
All right, let me get Carlo in Union Springs next on the phone. Go ahead, Carlo.
Hi, thank you. This information is very interesting, but nobody's talking about the huge growth in population in both Latin America and Africa. And in a way, this whole idea of the wall is almost a stopgap. I mean, I remember watching some of this commentary on the people coming to Europe from Syria. You saw young families of, young parents, maybe in their 20s or mid 30s, with 3, 4, 5 children. And we have, the U.S. Information Agency, I don't know if that's the exact name of it, but since the Clinton administration, Republicans in Congress have said they cannot speak to people, and this agency works in Africa, they cannot talk about birth control. And somehow, birth control and abortion have gotten conflated in this country and everywhere else. So the rise in illegal abortion in Africa, like in our own country, has risen because you can't have birth control, and it's somehow that's put under the rug. I've heard one conservative Christian say, you know, birth control leads to promiscuity. You know, that's like saying wearing seat belts will encourage you to speed, you know? So I'll get off the air. I'd like to hear what you guys have to say. It might be a subject for another show, to be honest.
Carlo, thanks for the phone call. Daniela, some thoughts on that?
Well, I think the issue points to maybe how, you know, conservative policies on reproductive rights and how we address issues of sexual and gender-based violence and reproductive rights in, you know, countries across the world, in Latin America and in Africa, are also, you know, under threat right now by this current administration. And they're very extremely important issues to deal with in areas like Central America that have very high levels of femicides and sexual and gender-based violence. And good responses to those types of issues are the kinds of programming that we wouldn't want to see cut, and that I think also get at why, you know, some people are fleeing the countries.
No doubt about it. When you talk to people like Todd Moss, who's going to be back on the program next week. He's an author, but he was also a former Undersecretary of Affairs for the Bush administration on parts of Africa. And they talk about the value of female empowerment, of empowering women around the world. That helps in remarkable ways when it comes to alleviating poverty and improving education, access. So Carla, maybe it is an entirely separate discussion in its own right, and I do appreciate the thought. Thank you for that phone call. John in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Yeah, I noticed your guest mentioned that blame America first on destabilization in Central and South America. What about the leftists? Intervention by Cuba and all the havoc they committed back, especially in the 1960s. That destabilized Central and South America also, and even Africa. But my question is this. You know, as a citizen of the United States, I resent sanctuary cities. I just resent the lawlessness of that concept. And the fact that a citizen of the United States, we dot our I's, we cross our T's, we do everything right, and yet this lawlessness of illegal aliens continues, and it's supported by Cuomo, Schumer, Obama, etc. It's slaughter. It's disgusting. We've got to take control of this country and promote lawful rights again in this country. It's out of control. Cesar Chavez, who was the founder of the United Farm Workers, was a opponent of illegal immigration. He actually formed squads to help Eisenhower and others to apprehend illegal aliens because he knew what that does to the economy. Number one, it decreases wages. It creates a surplus of labor and decreases wages. And this has got to be stopped.
All right, John, thanks for the phone call. A number of issues that he raised there, and I'm going to work backwards. On the issue of undocumented immigration, Daniela, does it decrease wages? Is it the position of LOG that is true?
No, we have not seen that to be true, actually. Again, by all the contributions that immigrants make to the U.S. economy, there's actually a figure that says that the 800 undocumented, the cost of eliminating protections for the 800,000 undocumented dreamers would cost the U.S. economy something like $4 billion over the next 10 years. So I think it's just one example of the different costs, not just wages, but also all the costs of these immigration enforcement operations would have.
And when it comes to sanctuary cities and counties, he says American citizens like himself do everything right, and he resents the lawlessness that he sees in sanctuary cities and counties. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, there's actually no law that says that local, state, and municipal police have to cooperate with federal immigration enforcement. There's a clear divide there. So there actually is no law that says they forcefully have to cooperate. And secondly, the sort of punishments that the administration is considering to punish the so-called sanctuary cities where police, you know, would have to cooperate with immigration to punish the cities that are sanctuary cities where police do not want to cooperate with federal immigration enforcement. Those types of punishments people don't realize, I think, go far beyond affecting just immigrants. They would actually make a lot of our cities and towns less safe because you're talking about cutting funds to police to punish them for not cooperating with federal immigration enforcement. You're talking about cutting the types of programs that are crucial to everyday citizens for reporting crimes. So sanctuary cities actually, in fact, are making that clear separation, I think, between federal immigration enforcement and state and local, and then also types of punishments would just make crimes, would make cities a lot less safer for everyone.
It is the position, just looking at Rochester as a city, Rochester City Council consulted with their city attorney, and their position as a sanctuary city is that is within the law. that they're not breaking the law
exactly.
and thus subject to these kind of sanctions anyway. But I know John and others will probably have a difference of opinion on that. I'm down to our last 30 seconds. Tonight, 7 p.m. at the Downtown United Presbyterian Church, Daniela is here for an event titled Human Rights in Mexico, Immigration and Two Borders. The event tonight at 7 p.m. is free and open to the public. What do you want people to know that you'll be talking about that we didn't get to, Daniela? Covered a lot of ground this hour.
Yes. Well, I'm going to be talking again about sort of the attacks from the administration, particularly on those more specific impacts, which I don't think we even got to half of them, on how those attacks are particularly affecting unaccompanied children and families from Mexico and Central America refugees.
Okay, that's tonight, 7 p.m. And I know it's a busy calendar. She's in from Washington, D.C. Thank you for making time for this program and our listeners today.
Thank you, Evan.
Daniela Bergy Palomino, the Senior Associate for Mexico, Border Issues and Migrant Rights at the Latin America Working Group. Also our thanks to Esperanza Roncero, Professor of Spanish in the Department of Foreign Languages and Literature at Nazareth College. I know we'll see you there tonight as well. Short break, more connections coming up next.